Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank since Wednesday rises to 3. Human rights groups renew calls for the closure of the U.S.-run Guantanamo prison on the 21st anniversary of the opening of the notorious facility. And Peru witnesses new clashes between police and demonstrators angry over the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Israeli brutalities against Palestinians show no sign of abating. The regime's forces have killed one more Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The victim has been identified as Samir Oni Harbi Aslan from the city of Al-Quds. The killing comes just a day after an Israeli settler fatally shot a 19-year-old Palestinian near the city of Al-Khamin, also known as Hebron. That followed an alleged stabbing attack on Wednesday. Israeli troops reportedly shot another young Palestinian man in the head during a raid on the Balata refugee camp. He later succumbed to his injury. Reacting to the fresh Israeli bloodshed, the resistance movement Hamas has said that the Palestinian people will continue to defend their land until it's liberated. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since early last year. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says the Israeli raid on the Qalandia refugee camp in the occupied West Bank is yet another act of violence against Palestinians.
This time, Israeli forces have raided Qalandia refugee camp between Al-Quds and Ramallah to conduct arrests among Palestinians as usual. During this operation, Israeli forces raided the narrow streets of Qalandia refugee camp and arrested from Qalandia 12 Palestinians, including the son of this Palestinian martyr, 17-year-old Ramzi Aslan. The Israelis wanted to arrest him, and here his father tried to prevent the Israeli soldiers from brutally taking his son and from beating him. However, Israeli forces opened fire at the father, Samir Aslan, and they stripped him from his clothes and left him on the ground. He was bleeding. A number of soldiers were around him. And it was, according to the footage that we have received, the Israeli soldiers were surrounding Aslan and left him bleeding until he succumbed to his injuries. Today, 18 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli forces, as I have mentioned. A dozen of them were arrested in the Qalandia refugee camp, and the remaining were arrested in the Dehesha refugee camp in Beit Lahem. In addition to one Palestinian was detained by the Israeli forces during a raid to Qalqilia, northern the occupied West Bank.
Doctors and medical experts in Yemen believe that Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces are using biological weapons, which are believed to be the reason for the increased cancer and birth defect cases in Yemen. Yusuf Mowry has more on that story.
Sana is dying. She was born just a few days ago, but because of a rare birth malformation, doctors believe she only has a few days to live. Sana is one of the thousands of Yemeni babies facing a similar fate. Here in the Sab'een Hospital in the Yemeni capital, doctors say they have been receiving birth defect cases at an alarming rate since 2015. That's when the Saudi-led coalition launched its war on Yemen. Doctors here are convinced that biological weapons were employed by the Saudis.
We've received many birth defect cases throughout the years. However, this is the first time we received a case like this. She does not have the bottom limbs or kidneys or even a urinary tract or liver. She's missing all of her bottom half organs. Malformation cases have risen significantly since 2015. We believe the rise in these cases is due to the hazardous poisons from the weapons being used in the war.
Cancer cases are also on the rise. The spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health says that the data and statistics recorded since the war started indicate that biological weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition are the main cause of the steady increase in cancer and birth defects.
These cases are rising in the areas that were targeted by illegal weapons in a number of provinces in Yemen, which has led to a significant increase of various kinds of cancer cases and also birth defects and miscarriages. It was never like this prior to the war.
We visited the registration office at Yemen's only oncology center. It was packed with people pushing their way to register for cancer treatment.
I am here to register for medication. I have oral cancer.
I have just received another case. The person who just registered is from Ebb and has liver cancer.
According to Yemen's Ministry of Health, the number of cancer patients increased by more than 50% since the war was launched in 2015. The Yemeni Ministry of Health says it will form a committee to officially investigate the main cause for the increase in birth defects and cancer cases in the areas that have been hit the most by the Saudi airstrikes. Even if it's evident that prohibited weapons were utilized by Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces, it is unlikely they will face prosecution, since most of the weapons used in the war are supplied by the American and British governments.
Doctors and medical experts say the increase in cancer and birth defect cases is rooted in the eight-year Saudi-led war that has polluted Yemen's air, water, and food. They blame the Saudi-led coalition's use of prohibited weapons such as biological weapons, toxic gases, and cluster bombs. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Asian stock markets push higher as China emerges from strict COVID restrictions and optimism for a pickup in demand grows. MSCI's broadest index of Asia-Pacific shares outside Japan rose 0.5% and touched an almost seven-month high. This comes as the fall in China's consumer inflation and a larger-than-expected drop in factory gate prices in December. Inflation in 2022 rose by an average of 2%, making China an outlier compared with other major economies, where prices soared the back of a spike in energy and food costs and supply chain volatility. There's hope that falling inflation will reduce the need for interest rate hikes. Well, a major British union says 100,000 members of its members will go on strike on February the 1st in a dispute with the government over pay, pensions, and job security. The announcement came at a time that the UK is experiencing a wave of strikes across all sectors, ranging from healthcare to railways. The Public and Commercial Services Union said it had warned the government their dispute would escalate if they did not listen. The union's secretary general added that the dispute could be resolved if more money was offered to its members. Different government departments and public sector bodies were hit with strikes over the last month as pay rises failed to keep pace with the double-digit inflation. Thousands of ambulance workers held a second day of strikes on Wednesday, while many schools in Scotland were closed by a teacher walkout. Well, for more insight on that, we're now joined by our very own Syed Puruzoz with us from the British capital, London. Syed, it's great to have you with us. I almost didn't recognize you there. Syed, talk to us about the recent announcement by the Public and Commercial Services Union. 100,000 of its members could go on strike. That could be devastating for the government.
It could be. It could be crippling for the different government departments, this announcement and the strike on the 1st of February. But then again, remember, it's not the first major strike. We do recall that the RNC, the Royal College of Nursing, voted for a strike that they have staged a couple of times since they did that. And that was by more than 100,000 members in their 106-year history. So this really adds to that. And if you live in Britain, it's really become a Sunday night routine at the moment to check with the public sector for the strike the following weekend. For example, try and avoid trains on Tuesdays and don't get sick on Wednesdays, as we saw ambulance workers go on strike yesterday. But then again, this is a dispute between the government that wants to come off as the fair but firm bulwark against the what it calls unreasonable demands of union barons. The unions are calling themselves the defenders of key workers, such as nurses, who haven't had a pay rise, a decent pay rise, since the 2010 financial crisis and the years of austerity that ensued. Today's announcement, it's important to say, comes 2 days after that meeting with the government failed to produce any tangible results or tangible commitments. It followed also by, on Tuesday, by a minimum services bill introduced by the government that has had many unions up in arms, calling it reprehensible, undemocratic, and that bill making it illegal for unions to stop working altogether, that they have to provide minimum service in times of industrial actions. And these are six sectors, a number of them, just to mention a few, the NHS, railway, and fire service. So the dispute is ongoing. There was a meeting between the unions yesterday and the Transport Select Committee. These were Ambulance Drivers Union, the RMT, the Railway Maritime and Transport Union, and another one. And it was obvious that both sides were steadfast in what they wanted to do. The union said they were farther away from a deal than when they had started. And the government side also said that they wanted to be fair but firm. So neither party is backing down at the moment, which is why we're seeing at least one strike every single day this month, and we're looking at more strikes coming up in the following month, starting with the one that you announced on February 1st. People are offering solutions. One thing that is noteworthy is that the government might take the Welsh route or the German route, which is to offer people in the public sector a one-off payment on top of what they call a consolidated pay rise. And the pay rise, of course, is decided by every union or every sector's pay review body. And what the pay review body does, and it has plenty of data, so does the government, they know that there are problems in the different public sectors. They know that these industries are having problems with recruitment and retention. So what the pay review body does, that it announces how much the raise should be. But the problem with that is that they have data that is released months prior. And with the fast-moving conditions and situation in the country, they can't seem to keep pace. For instance, when they announced the NHS's pay rise in July, they were basing it on data that had been released months before, whereas now inflation is at more than 10%. Therefore, the unions have a problem with that and are calling on the government to come up with a pay packet that is in keeping with the double-digit inflation. Having said that, as I say, it is possible that the government will agree to make a one-off payment that, in addition to the pay rise suggested or recommended by the pay review bodies of the different industries.
All right, thanks a lot, Saeed Puruz, for joining us from the British capital, London. Moving on, rights advocacy groups have renewed their calls for the closure of the U.S.-run infamous Guantanamo Bay prison, which has a colossal legacy of abuse. On the 21st anniversary of the opening of the notorious facility, some 160 international rights groups has sent a joint letter to U.S. President Joe Biden urging him to shut it down. The facility is a symbol of Washington's so-called war on terror and is globally known for widespread violations of human rights there. Some detainees released from there and even U.S. personnel had recounted harrowing stories of torture, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and forced feeding. One rights group has described the prison as a symbol of injustice and disregard for the rule of law. The prison has never been closed despite promises by respective American presidents. Another political embarrassment for the White House, as aides to the president have reportedly discovered more classified documents from a location Joe Biden previously used. The initial batch of files was discovered in November at a Biden private office, but only came to light this week. The records, including intelligence memos and briefings, date back to Biden's vice presidency. The president claims he didn't know about those files and was taken by surprise. The White House has yet to comment on the newly discovered materials. The Republican Majority House of Representatives has requested information from Twitter and the Treasury Department. The House has already voted to create a new committee to launch an investigation into the issue. Former President Donald Trump is also facing a criminal probe for allegedly keeping classified files, despite calls by the National Archives to turn them over. There's no end in sight to violence in Peru over the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo. New clashes have erupted between police and Castillo supporters who were trying to take over the airport in the southeastern city of Cusco. In some videos circulating online, demonstrators could be seen receiving assistance for their injuries. A prosecutor says the protesters were off to repeat what unfolded in the city of Juliaca, where 17 people were killed after demonstrators tried to take the city's airport on Monday. Peru has been roiled by protests since last month after Castillo was removed from office and taken into custody. People are calling for his release as well as the resignation of new president Dina Boluarte. More than 40 Peruvians have been killed during the unrest so far. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Leaders meeting with women active in science, society and culture. On Wednesday, 4th of January 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a group of women noted for their activities in science, culture and society at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Wednesday, 4th of January, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a large gathering of prominent Iranian women, all of them active in science, culture and society. The meeting follows a request last year by a group of women for an exclusive meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Many topics were discussed at this meeting, among them giving expert and academic women a bigger role in policy-making and decision-making at all levels, including the highest levels of the government. The leader emphasized that a way should be found to make this happen. Another topic of discussion was the difference between the status of women in Islam and in Western societies. The leader poignantly added, "Modern Western society has commented on virtually every aspect of life during the past 200 years. But with regards to women, Westerners have mistreated women, exploited women, treated them as sexual objects, committed crimes against women, and are certainly guilty." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei talked about Islam's viewpoint with regard to gender and the issue of women. He said, "Regarding the Islamic viewpoint, it can be said that Islam sees individuals as human beings. Men and women have no priority over each other, and they are both human beings. They're not different in this. The equality of men and women in terms of human and Islamic values is one of the clear principles of Islam. There is no doubt about this." The leader recited Ayah 35 of Surah Ahzab in the Holy Quran that states, "Indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women, the faithful men and the faithful women, the obedient men and the obedient women, the truthful men and the truthful women, the patient men and the patient women, the humble men and the humble women, the charitable men and the charitable women, the men who fast and the women who fast, the men who guard their chastity and the women who guard their chastity, the men who remember Allah greatly and the women who remember Allah greatly. Allah holds in store for them forgiveness and a great reward." The leader emphasized that there is no difference between men and women in terms of human and Islamic values. Islam regards men and women as human beings. Neither one is more favored than the other. Turning to the duties of men and women, which are different, the leader said there is a balance in this regard. He added, "There is a holy law mentioned in the Holy Quran in Ayah 228 of Surah Baqarah, where the Almighty says, 'And women also have rights similar to those of men over them, in accordance with Islamic law. Women have the same number of rights over men as men have rights over women. When a duty is assigned to someone, they have a right in return for it. For every privilege there is given to either side, there is a responsibility. Thus, there is a complete balance. That is about the rights of men and women. Therefore, they do not have the same rights and duties, but it is balanced. When we look at responsibilities, emphasis is placed on the natural characteristics of men and women. There are certain differences between men and women, that is, in the female nature and in the male nature. There are both physical and spiritual differences between men and women. Their duties are in accordance with these differences. These differences have an effect on the type of responsibilities assigned to men and women. This has to do with a feminine and a masculine nature." Turning to the status of women in the modern capitalist West, Ayatollah Khomeini stressed that Western capitalism is a patriarchal system. He pointedly added, "What they attribute to Islam, which is incorrect and is the opposite of the truth, exists in their own capitalist system." This viewpoint stems from the fact that in capitalism, capital, that is money or wealth, is more important than humanity. Humans serve capitalism by generating wealth. Whoever is able to generate and accumulate more wealth, that is, more capital, has a higher status in the capitalist system. The leader stressed further, "Generally, it is men who manage Western economies, and big businesses are run by men. Therefore, men have priority over women in capitalism. Since capital is more in the hands of men, men have a higher priority. So, in the Western system, capital determines the status of people, and people are no longer the same. Different amounts of wealth for each individual gives them different status." Turning to how women are abused in the capitalist West, Ayatollah Khamenei pointed to two ways in which women are abused. He added, "One is in the workplace itself. This is an important point. In many Western countries right now, women receive lower wages than men for the same type of work when they perform similar work. Also, in the 19th century, Western women were encouraged to leave their homes and to work in factories where they received much lower wages than men." Commenting on the US Civil War, the leader said, "The same thing happened with regards to the freedom of black people in America during the American Civil War in 1860. That is almost 160 years ago. Over 1 million people were killed in this Civil War. During the Civil War, the issue of freedom of black slaves was raised. Southern United States was mostly agricultural, whereas Northern United States was industrialized. The African-American or the black slaves were mostly in the South, where they were used for farming. The people in the North needed cheap labor. They needed these black people, the African-Americans. The controversy over freeing the slaves was initiated by the people in Northern United States. Factories in the North needed cheap labor, cheap workers, so black slaves in Southern United States were freed to work as cheap labor in northern U.S. factories. It is the same method of deception used by the civilized gentleman in the West when dealing with various issues. There are many other such examples." Commenting on the second way in which Western women are abused, the leader said, "Western women are exploited and used to provide pleasure to men. It is actually very difficult for me to talk about this subject in any gathering, but especially in a gathering with women. But this is the reality. What can we do? They did everything they could to convince women that their value and worth was dependent on their behavior in trying to make themselves more sexually attractive to men. They did everything they could. It is a very sad story." The leader added, "I have read many things in this regard. It is very difficult to talk about this. In one American magazine, which was shown to me around 7, 8, or 10 years ago, a very famous American businessman who owned a chain of restaurants announced that he was hiring people. But what type of people? He was hiring young girls and young women under the conditions which were written down in their contract. One of these conditions was that the length of their dress or the length of their skirt needed to be a certain amount above their knees. They had even published a photograph of how the women should look like serving in these restaurants." Turning to the West's shamelessness and brazenness, the leader poignantly remarked, "With all the harm and all that they have inflicted upon women, to a woman's dignity and her honor, they pretend to be the flag bearers of women's rights. That is, Westerners are misusing the case of women's rights in the world for their own intentions. This is truly the ultimate shamelessness by the West. Despite all that, they still say they support women and are in favor of women's rights. This is what is called women's freedom in the impious language of the West. When they say women's freedom, what they really mean is this type of freedom. These things are freedom in their opinion. But in actual fact, this is not freedom. This is slavery. They are insulting women. Commenting on homosexuality in the West, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The legalization of things such as homosexuality in the West, which is forbidden in all divine religions. Talk about homosexuality being forbidden and things like that is not just something found in Islam. These are major sins in all religions. They legalize these and they really do not even feel ashamed about it. Therefore, one of the actions that is obligatory in our society is that we must strictly avoid the Western viewpoint on issues such as gender and sexuality." Commenting further, the leader said, "Praise God. Learned, wise, intelligent, educated women like yourselves exist everywhere. And this group, which is sitting here today, is a sample of the population. You are a flower from a great floral garden. Praise God, we have a large number of discerning, judicious, educated, well-informed women throughout this country." The leader went on to talk about issues of women's role in the subject of family. The leader asked, "So what is a woman's role in the family environment?" He added, "Just as you would not be able to breathe if there was no air in the environment, that is how it would be if there was no woman in your family unit. The woman in the family unit is like fresh air that is breathed in that environment. So, a woman sometimes assumes the role of a wife in the family, and at other times she assumes the role of a mother. There are certain attributes for each role. In the role of a wife, a woman is primarily a manifestation of calm, as it says in the Holy Quran, and made from its mate that he might find comfort with her. She's a source of calm because life has its ups and downs. In this sea of life, a man is busy with work and the turbulence. When he comes home, he needs calm, he needs comfort. This comfort is created by the woman of the house. A woman is a source of tranquility, love and serenity. A woman's role as a wife is to provide love and serenity." Further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution went on to talk about Islamic hijab. He said, "I would also like to add that in recent events, you saw how they worked against hijab and such things. Who were the ones who stood up to these efforts and incitements? The women themselves. The women stood up to them. The enemies had pinned their hopes on these women, who you say are wearing a bad form of hijab. They had pinned their hopes on them. They were hoping that these women would have incomplete hijab, would remove it completely. But they didn't. They slammed those propagandists and instigators in the West." The leader added, "The final thing that I would like to mention is that women have made great progress in the Islamic Republic of Iran in such fields as academia, universities, medicine, cutting-edge technologies, sports, etc." The leader also wished all Iranian women prosperity and success.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the new year 2023, there isn't much to cheer about, economically speaking. That is because the news is grim when it comes to the state of the world economy. And that is an understatement. The World Bank has made a big cut to its 2023 growth outlook, saying that the globe is perilously close to recession. This is while going into the new year, the world was suffering from massive inflation, like in the EU and the US as examples. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the reasons behind this gloomy outlook, how we got to this in the first place, and whether there are any signs that the world economy will improve anytime soon. Joining us to discuss this is Clab Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst who joins us from London. Clab Menzies, welcome. So, you know, there's a barrage of bad news that's coming out, so it was worthy of us to try to explore that in this program. One of them is the World Bank making big cuts to its forecast, I guess, for 2023. The global growth outlook, it has stated, is perilously close to recession, where it slashes economy or growth outlook for the economy to 1.7% for 2023 from 3% projection that it had set. What do you think is going on here? I mean, what can we say about this?
Well, I think, good evening, and I think one should not be surprised by what's happening. What I find quite incredible is that anybody who follows the sort of the blow-by-blow accounts in the mainstream media doesn't seem to be able to stand back and look at the trajectory that we have been following. And this was predictable probably since the global financial crisis in 2008, primarily because of the responses thereto. And we were warning as long ago as 7 years ago that we were heading for a global economic collapse. And last summer, when the governor of the Bank of England was suggesting that they were going to adhere to their 2% inflation target, that seemed somewhat laughable. The primary mechanisms that are causing this crisis have been long-standing. One is the excessive money supply. So there's been money supply or money printing by the central banks, the major central banks, ever since 2008, and that has accelerated in the last 3 years, since September 2019, specifically with the Fed. This whole false climate narrative that has been fabricated with the ESG diktat that all companies have to conform to is also a contributory factor because it's driven up energy costs. And I know that the World Bank cited Ukraine as being one of the factors in all of this, but actually it is nothing to do with Ukraine itself. It's to do with the sanctions. I was on a program in May 2022 where all of the commentators, including myself, were suggesting that the EU and primarily shot itself in the foot, but with America's encouragement, because it's the sanctions that has created this this acute problem that we have now. But having said all that, even without Ukraine war, we would still be in this mess because the trajectory has been driving us here through excess money and energy policies that make no sense and have no basis in reality because there is no climate crisis.
All right, so I jotted down some of the things that you were talking about, and I want to ask you about this one particular one that is mentioned time and again, and you have also mentioned that time and again, and that is the fact that is somewhat, obscure or not really that clear when it comes to money supply, money printing, and the excess money. You know, we keep hearing about this, so the first question is, what is the theory behind it? But more importantly, where did the money go? I mean, you know, we're talking about a lot of money here that was pumped out by the central banks, correct?
Indeed. There was an article in I wrote in an investment magazine, I think it was in 2018, where I showed a graph showing central bank, primarily the Fed and the ECB, and I think there may have been the Bank of England. And if you track the trajectory of the S&P 500, so it's an investment index of one of the main board indices of the American stock market, you could actually track that when the market weakened off, the central banks would intervene and create more money. And the mechanism that they used was primarily by basically taking bad debt off the commercial banks' books and basically just issuing more debt. And I don't know if you've seen more recently than in Japan, for example, they've actually gone to another stage of money creation, which is probably going to blow up in their face. So it's central banks
what
around
stage is
the
that?
World.
What kind of program they, are you referring to with Japan that you mentioned there?
Well, it's something I've not looked into more recently. It was reported on UK column yesterday by David Scott that the Bank of Japan, not only have they increased their main base rate from 0.25 to 0.50, but they've undertaken a further buying program of government bonds. So they issue new government bonds and they take them on their own books. So it's just monetizing the debt. You ask where the money goes. The money, up until quite recently, until this inflation in the real economy started, has been going into asset prices, which is why we've seen stock markets, property prices, and all sorts of investments actually achieve record highs. What has happened, obviously, in the so-called COVID period, which is a whole other debate, basically they collapsed the real economy, so it wouldn't, all this money printing wouldn't actually appear in the real economy. Now that the COVID story has, if you like, rolled back because people are less amenable to being sort of intimidated into closing down their economic activity, there is now obviously activity, and we're seeing it creeping in on food prices, energy prices, etc. And let's not forget, along with this climate nonsense, they're also trying to destroy food production, particularly in Holland, where there has been a policy to actually stop people farming. And that is not exclusive to Holland. It's been a general trend across
Why
Western...
Why would they do that?
That's a very big question that has an answer. But essentially, we've been at war since 2001, and this is a war of the structure, which is those that believe that they can control the world centrally. They believe that there are too many of us on the planet, 7.8 billion or whatever the latest figure is. So they're looking to reduce the population and at the same time exercise control. And if you control food, then you control populations. I'm afraid that these sorts of ideas you will never see in a mainstream narrative because they just seem too fantastical. But when you look at the work, the research that we've been involved in, this is a collaborative research project looking out from many different perspectives, shows that this is undoubtedly agenda. That's what COVID was about. That's what climate change is about. And this is what the, if you like, the destruction and the so-called greening of the planet is about, is to destroy farming and food production. And I'm not saying that agribusinesses or industrial-scale farming should be protected, because there are better ways of doing things. But this is all about centralizing control, centralizing production, and reducing everybody's footprint, which effectively means that the carbon they are trying to reduce is the carbon life form, which is human beings.
Well, when you talk about the food, I'm looking down at what I have on food for to propose a question to you for. And I'm looking at food insecurity, where it's projected to reach a new peak, which was last experienced in 2007, 2008. And it cites a combination of factors, and it says the supply chain disruptions, COVID-19 pandemic, the war in Ukraine, rising inflation, high commodity prices. But the narrative that you just spelled out is somewhat different. It may contain that, but it's somewhat different. Clive, you're going into the fact that you are saying overall that you want that you're saying that this is going to be centrally controlled in terms of, for example, food, and therefore there is a push for the population to decrease as a result of the way that food supply is controlled. If I understood you correctly, is that accurate?
Yeah, in small part, I think the two go together. There is a general. You only have to look across the world, more in the West than anywhere else, that they're actually reducing production of food. And one of the points that we made back in May, when this sanctions regime started against Russia because of what's going on in Ukraine, the sanctions were bound to be self-destructive because Europe is heavily dependent on imports for food. And Russia has plenty of energy and it has plenty of food. So there is a concerted effort. There are certain areas of the states where you can actually be prosecuted for growing your own food. There are stories of people being arrested for feeding the hungry. I mean, these are small indicators of something much bigger. But this is all coordinated because if you look through every government, whether you're talking about Canada, New Zealand, Australia, countries across Europe, they're all adopting the same policies. Now, is it coincidence or is it planned? And our analysis would suggest that most of this is run by those that control the money system, i.e. those that control the central banks and the large commercial banks. Uh-huh. And there is a concerted plan which brings together a lot of strands of what we've been talking about in terms of economic collapse in order to create disruption, in order to reorder the world. I think there's a Latin phrase which escapes me at the moment, but it essentially means order out of chaos, and that is the strategy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let me introduce our guest, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst who joins us from Brussels. Welcome. You've walked into, if I was walking into this conversation, I wouldn't know where to start. But Elijah Magnier, I'll start with one of the statements that amongst many bleak predictions for the world for the year 2023. This one I'm going to hit you with is from the IMF. One-third of the world economy expected to be in a recession. And it says it's because of the three big economies, U.S., EU, and China. And the bleak part of that, not that any of it was positive, says that half of EU is going to be in a recession. Elijah Magnier, what are we looking at when we're seeing all these bleak assessments that have been made? I'm sure you've read some of them, like this one from the IMF.
We are looking at the general recession that will hit the world, not only Europe or few parts of the world, because the deterioration per capita income growth will be slower even in rich country, and that is due to several factors. Mainly, above all, is COVID, where the whole world was blocked for a very long time, and we were already told that we're going to be hit by an inflation. And secondly, are the U.S. measures against country like Venezuela, Iran, and Russia to start imposing sanctions and prevent the flow of oil and energy that can contribute to bring down the prices, because everything follows the price of the oil. We have seen in March when the petrol reached $120 and today is around 80, when budget around the world in rich oil country producers is set up between $40 to $50 a barrel. So if we bring that down already and we lift all these sanctions, that is the best hobby of the US to break the will of the population and impoverish the population. We have seen now that the US has adopted another policy, pushing the EU to commit a suicide by imposing sanctions that have a devastating boomerang effect. And we in Europe are suffering greatly. We pay the bill of gas and electricity. I used to pay 70 euros per month. A few days ago, I paid 340, and I am one individual living in a small place. So we can imagine the effect of prices on everything else that is affected in the market, and we can't live.
So what do you mean when you say the U.S. is pursuing a boomerang effect type approach? Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, Russia sells the gas to Europe and to China and to other countries with 30% discount. Today, we're buying it at the price market plus 4 to 10% from Norway and from the U.S., but we're also buying it from Azerbaijan, from Algeria, but we're paying much more than the price that we used to pay. Moreover, Europe is not equipped to liquid gas that we are buying from the US and other places because we don't have these terminals. All the economy is based on that, and then we have to renew all the infrastructure. We don't have the money to do it, and that will cost a lot, and then we see many companies are closing their doors. And by closing the doors and seeing China that is buying the Russian gas at 30% discount of the Russian price, then the economy in Russia is going to be more attractive than the European industry because it's going to be much more expensive. The Chinese industry is going to be available at a very adequate price that we cannot afford because we're paying the price of energy much higher, and then we're paying also the price of food, the transport, everything else follows the price of the energy. So if the U.S. stop playing with this very dangerous game by imposing sanctions on countries, by now pushing Russia, pushing China to an arms race by signing deals with Taiwan, with Japan, by increasing the Japanese GDP of weapons and armament, the double, by the UK signing another deal with Japan today, all that give us an indication that the US are really insinuating to the Chinese, we're going to come after you through Taiwan, and that will create tension the market is not going to like at all. This is why there will be a panic again in the market, uh-huh. Where there will be many areas of insecurity, and that will increase the inflation. Hence, the recession is going to hit us all.
Clive Menzies, tell us the role that the U.S. and the U.S. economy actually plays in this whole thing, because we know on the one hand the U.S. financial system is integrated throughout the world in terms of how it can impact the flow of money, the dollar and its function. And, of course, what our guest there from Brussels was saying, the U.S. foreign policy approach is in terms of sanctions, for example, sanctioning countries like Russia, like China, and even Iran, and how this all emanates from the U.S. in some sense that perhaps affects the world economic growth. I mean, if that even makes sense for me to ask it that way.
Yes, I think it does. I mean, we've lived in a dollar world since the end of World War II, or Bretton Woods. And I think what's becoming increasingly obvious is that certainly in the last year or so, but probably for quite a long time before that, the dollar, its days are numbered. In addition, the U.S. has basically been leaning on most other countries because of its military might and the strength of the dollar, and that is less potent than it used to be. I mean, by population, I think in terms of numbers of people, when you take in India, China, and other countries, the majority of the global population are against what America is doing in Ukraine, for example. And if one looks at what is happening, what is clearly evident from the Ukraine conflict is that Russian military sophistication could possibly exceed that of the US. There is certainly problems in the UK military in terms of morale and political correctness has sort of crept in and reduced its effectiveness as a force. So I think this, we're witnessing a dying empire, but what we're seeing more than anything is plunder. So the Biden administration is heavily involved in the corruption. The Ukraine, even before March this year, had turned into some sort of gangster state where there's a lot of money laundering going on. You may be aware of the FTX debacle where this cryptocurrency outfit has been washing money through Ukraine back into the Democrat Party.
Right.
And we're seeing the end of plunder and...
Okay.
And it's so obvious everywhere, but it's being led from the States.
Sure. Sorry to jump in here and cut you off, but I just want to give Elijah Magnier, and unfortunately we're out of time, the last question here. So, Elijah Magnier, when you take a look at countries that have the energy, i.e. oil and gas, such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, Venezuela, we're looking at countries that are not pro-U.S., obviously, because these are being sanctioned. How much of a factor will that play in if they were to unite against the U.S., in terms of trying to regain that whole idea of globalization and not have what the world is experiencing now, which is this high energy prices, and that for there to be a balance. But, of course, the U.S. would be left out. Under a minute, if you can.
Well, what the Americans are doing is allowing Venezuela to produce between 200,000 to 400,000 barrels of oil per day, enough for Venezuela to survive and for the Americans to take what they need because they import 700,000 from Russia. So they find alternative, but not enough for Venezuela to survive. If the U.S. stop playing this game, because at the end of the day, the U.S. is indebted to $33 trillion, but it is in dollars. They can print it any time, okay. And they don't care, really. So sure. At the end of the day, their devastating policy and destructive policy is one of the major causes of what's happening in the world.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry to cut you off. We're just fresh out of time. But thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. And thank you, Clive Menzies, as a pleasure, researcher and political economy analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahoy and the team, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Rabbana Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al Musavi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers, sisters, dear listeners. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zainul Abidin alayhi salamullah. We go to the part where the Imam salamullah alayhi asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and seeks refuge in him from number of things. And he says, وَإِيثَارِ الْبَاطِلِ عَلَى الْحَقِّ, and to prefer falsehood over truth. Now, when it comes to truth and falsehood is a topic of its own that requires a program of its own. But having said that, we can still talk about it very quickly and relate it to our program. Now, there are three words here. Ithar,